Hello, it's Friday the 16th of July and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-ho. President Moon Jae-in has described this weekend as a critical crossroad in the country's efforts to curb the latest wave of COVID-19 infections and has called on citizens to limit their movements. We'll have more on the pandemic situation in our news briefing shortly. Then later on Weekly Economy Review, we'll discuss how next year's minimum wage hike of 5.1% has left neither business nor labour sectors happy. Plus, on Movie Spotlight, we'll have two new occult horror films to review. Our critics will be giving their thoughts on that. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. South Korea has hit another four-digit daily COVID-19 infection count as temperatures rise for the summer months. With incoming vacationers, regional governments outside of the Seoul metro area are considering tightening their social distancing curbs. To discuss all this, as well as our other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hello, Jang-ho.
Now, before we get to the daily toll for today, can you start us off with a cluster that's forming outside of the country, on the seas? The military is now weighing bringing home all members of a naval unit as multiple COVID-19 cases have been confirmed among them.
Right, we're talking about crew members aboard the naval destroyer Munmu the Great, which has been on an anti-piracy mission near the continent of Africa for months. The military confirmed on Thursday that six service members of the 34th contingent of the Cheonghae unit tested positive for COVID-19, with another 80 of the 300 members on board showing symptoms. They have been quarantined and all aboard are being PCR tested, with results expected to come out on Saturday. None were vaccinated as a unit was dispatched in February ahead of vaccinations beginning here in South Korea. The head of the unit reportedly sent a message to families of crew members on Thursday saying that the military is looking into bringing everyone home on aerial tankers, which could be sent as early as this weekend. Consultations with foreign missions in Africa are said to be underway on the timing of the crew's return, which is likely to fall sometime next week.
Now, this comes as in South Korea, the country logged more than 1,500 COVID-19 cases on Friday.
Yeah, it's a slight dip from the 1,600s of the previous 2 days, but still represents the third largest daily case count since the start of the pandemic here in Korea. The KDCA said 60 were overseas transmissions and that 75% of domestic infections came from the greater metro area. Meanwhile, outside of the capital region, there were one shy of 370 cases, accounting for 25% of all local infections.
And in light of this situation, the Prime Minister has asked regional governments to consider capping their limits for private gatherings at 4 people to avoid confusion among the public.
Right. Prime Minister Kim Boo-gyeom making the call during a government meeting on COVID-19 response Friday, as there are multiple caps in place right now for private gatherings from 4 to 6 to 8 people, depending where you are geographically. Discussions are underway between local governments and the central government regarding that unified cap, with an announcement to come as early as Sunday. According to analysis of cell phone data for movements on Tuesday, movement in the capital region did register a drop by 11% compared to the week earlier, but movements outside of the Seoul metro area had risen 9% in the same period, which is partially why the government has their eyes in regions outside of the capital.
Yes, and despite government calls to stay put, many are heading to the resort island of Jeju, it seems, for the summer months. The government there will now raise its social distancing level in response, effective Monday.
Right. Travelers are saying that this is a vacation they had planned months earlier, so they are moving forward with it with the intention of strictly adhering to social distancing. But yes, the government on Jeju Island, which has been at level 2 since last Monday, has said that it will impose a level 3 upgrade, the second highest in the four-tier system, starting next Monday. This comes as nightlife establishments on the resort island were placed under a no-assembly order from Thursday, as the number of infections linked to entertainment venues did grow amid new cases being confirmed among visitors. Now, level 3 distancing is also set to kick in Gangneung, Gangwon-do province, effective tomorrow for those of you who might be heading there for the weekend. Under Level 3, private gatherings would be limited to 4 people, with the cap applying to family members as well, unless you live together under one roof.
And President Moon Jae-in is calling for citizens to limit their movements and refrain from meeting others as much as possible, underlying that this weekend is a quote-unquote critical crossroad in the country's efforts to curb the latest COVID-19 outbreak.
Indeed, he made the point in a social media post on Friday as people head into the weekend or are thinking about weekend plans. President Moon, before calling the weekend a critical crossroad, as you said, stressed the frightening speed of the Delta variant spread. He went on to say that everyone's cooperation is indispensable to achieving a short and forceful level 4 distancing effect, adding that the country must overcome the virus and return to normal. He recognized medical workers and others keeping the front lines, thanking them for their perseverance amid the sizzling summer heat.
On to other news next. The vice foreign ministers of South Korea, the U.S. and Japan are set to hold their first face-to-face in years next week.
Yeah, it will be the first trilateral vice foreign ministers meeting among those countries in 4 years and is set to take place in Tokyo on Wednesday. First, Vice Foreign Minister Choi Jong-kun will meet with U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, as well as Japanese Vice Foreign Minister Maro Takeo, as the three sides discuss cooperation on pressing shared challenges, including regional security issues such as North Korea. Vice Minister Choi is also expected to hold a separate bilateral meeting with his Japanese counterpart during his 2-day trip. Meanwhile, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman will be in the region for a week-long tour starting on Sunday, and she is set to arrive in Seoul on Wednesday before moving on to Mongolia. It remains unclear, though, whether her trip will include a stopover in China.
And finally, we're set to have more holidays this calendar year in South Korea, as the government has decided which holidays will be designated alternative holidays if they fall on a weekend.
Yeah, it looks like we'll have 3 more holidays in the Mondays following Liberation Day, National Foundation Day, and Hangul Day, as they will qualify for alternative holidays under the revision and as all 3 fall on a weekend this year. The Ministry of Personal Management issued on Friday an advance notice of revisions to regulations on designating alternate holidays, in which it outlined its decision to designate the alternate holidays only for national holidays, which include the 3 I've already mentioned, plus the March 1st Independence Movement Day. What this will not apply then will be Christmas or Buddha's birthday, as they are considered public and not national holidays. The revisions also noted that the designation of alternative holidays will have to be carried out through a cabinet vote.
That'll be all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
You bet.
It's time now for Weekly Economy Review, our Friday in-depth corner. This week, we discuss an announcement that South Korea will set its hourly minimum wage for next year at 9,161, an increase of more than 5%. But this has drawn backlash from both the business and labor sectors. We'll delve into that shortly. In addition, we'll also discuss a recent survey which suggests that more than a third of women in Korea drop out of the workforce within 5 years of their marriage. To help us look deeper at all of these issues, we have joining us on the line now economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor Yang, hello.
Hello.
We kick things off with our regular look back at the week's stock markets. How did the KOSPI and KOSDAQ fare this week?
Okay, KOSPI for the last week, it was up and down, but it was generally a rising trend for the week. It ended today at 3,276.91. For the week, it's up 1.8%. KOSDAQ, it was, again, upward trend for the week, but it came down today only. It ended today at 1,051.98, and it's up 2.2% for the entire week. U.S. dollar, it appreciated on Wednesday and Thursday, but it depreciated today. It ended today at 1,142.00. It appreciated 0.5% for the week.
Now on to our main topic. The minimum wage for next year has been decided at 9,161 per hour. That's up 5.1% from this year, which was 8,721 per hour. This figure was reached by the Minimum Wage Commission, which consists of 9 representatives each from labour, business and the general public. Now, this decision was announced on Monday, but as I mentioned earlier, there has been backlash from both business and labour sectors. Before we get into all that, though, Professor, could you first walk us through how the decision was made?
As you mentioned, the Minimum Wage Commission has 27 voting members, 9 from labor, but the labor members are mostly from national labor unions, and 9 from businesses. Those are mostly business organizations such as taxi cooperatives and beauty salon cooperatives. And then 9 representing the public interest. These members are mostly academics or researchers. So these members, especially the labor members and business members, do not represent necessarily just the workers or businesses which deal with minimum wages. They deal with the entire economy. And because minimum wage affects wages for all workers, whether they receive minimum wages or not, some wages are designed as multiples of minimum wage. And even if they're not explicitly multiples of minimum wage, it does affect non-minimum wage as well. So in a sense, the fight for minimum wage represents in part wage fight for the entire economy, which is why this is so politically sensitive. Businesses, their initial offer was that the minimum wage do not change from this year's minimum wage of $8,721. Labor's initial offer was $10,801, and they did just a little bit close, 8,741, rise of 21 for the businesses, and 10,401, a fall of 401 for labor. Mm. So the chairman and the public interest members made a unilateral offer and offered a yes or no vote, which was the amount of 9,161. The business members objected and abstained. 4 labor members objected and they left the voting area. So in the end, the minimum wage was passed with 13 approval, 10 abstaining, and 4 not voting at all. And the new minimum wage is expected to affect 4.36 million workers directly. But as I mentioned, it will affect virtually all wage earners in Korea.
Right, so we can clearly see that there's some controversy about how this figure was reached. The business sector is saying it's too excessive and the labour is saying it's not enough. Can you expand a little bit more for us the stances being made by these two sides?
Okay, well, the business position that the minimum wage should not be raised. Their justification was small businesses cannot afford the higher minimum wage, especially after the coronavirus recession that we've been undergoing, and that minimum wage has been rising too quickly during the Moon administration and the previous administrations. And then the business sector also offered a study saying that if minimum wages go above 9,000 won per hour, 1,300 and 4,000 jobs will disappear. Now, on the labor side, President Moon, during his election campaign, made a promise that the minimum wage would be more than 10,000 won during his administration. In fact, by the third or fourth year of his administration, so that promise has already been delayed. And labor also offered a justification that the minimum wage, as it is currently, does not offer a living wage for a person who has a minimum wage job. Now, Moon administration, during the early part of their administration in 2018 and 2019, raised the minimum wage by 16% and 10%. And over the last 10 years, the minimum wage more than doubled, outstripping inflation and regular wage rises. So the minimum wage has risen very quickly in Korea for the last few years. And partially because of that, in 2019 and 2020, the 2020 and 2021, the minimum wage did not rise by very much, and labor has been very unsatisfactory because of that. Now, because of the 5.1% increase in next year's minimum wage, the average annual increase in minimum wage for the Moon administration is 7.3%, but the average minimum wage rise for the Park Geun-hye, the previous administration, is going to be 7.4%. So Moon administration must be a little bit embarrassed because they were the so-called liberal administration, but their average increase in minimum wage is going to be less than the previous administration, which was conservative.
Right. Isn't there an argument that could be made, though, that the minimum wage was too low even during before the Park Geun-hye administration as well?
Well, during the Park Geun-hye administration, you could conceivably make an argument for that. But right now, you probably have to make the argument that minimum wage relative to the Korea's GDP levels is too high. And the reason is that if you take the minimum wage as a percentage of GDP, or how more commonly how we do it is, say that you have a minimum wage job that you work for the entire year, so 40 hours per week and 52 weeks per year, then your wages, how much is it going to be compared to per capita GDP? Now, in Korea, this figure comes down to 59.4%. And of the advanced countries, the OECD countries, only New Zealand is higher at 62.2%. Japan, it's 36%. U.S., it's 26%. Germany, 48%. Even the country which is known to have a very high welfare system, like France, it's only 50.8%. So Korea, compared to its per capita GDP, actually has a very high minimum wage. So you can conceivably say that Korea actually does have, given its GDP levels, minimum wage that is very high. And another way that this is reflected is that about 16% of eligible workers who are supposed to get minimum wage actually works for less than the minimum wage. And if you look at just the people in their 20s, that's about 18%. And if you look at the people who are working for small companies of less than five workers, 36% gets actually less than minimum wage. What this tells you is that these people would rather work, have a job than have a job that earns less than minimum wage than not have a job. I think that argues that Korea minimum wage right now may be too high.
I see. Well, the business lobby has said it will lodge an official complaint. I understand technically the minimum wage decision could still change. Both labor and management can challenge the decision between July 19th and July 29th. And if deemed reasonable, the labor ministry can request a review by the Minimum Wage Commission. However, that has never before happened before once it is set by the commission, so it is unlikely, but we will keep an eye out for any developments. Next, we wanted to discuss another labour issue today. According to a survey by the Korea Labour Institute, it said that 68% of women at the start of their marriage are employed, but that drops to 40% among women in their fifth year of marriage. That suggests that some 40% of women who had jobs leave the workforce once they get married and start to have children. The employment rate among married women does not return to the 68% range until 21 years of marriage later. In contrast, the employment rate for men rises after marriage and remains steady in the 90% range during the same 21-year period. Now, this suggests that child-rearing remains a major obstacle for women in continuing their careers. Professor, what are your thoughts on this survey?
Okay, well, another point that the study, I think, tried to show is that it takes too long for female workers to return to the labor force. Obviously, because only women can give birth, the employment rate for women, if you compare it overall, practically does have to be lower than men. But still, the point, I think, of this paper is that it goes down too low. Now, if you look at some details in the report, the first child has a major impact on the employment decision. Second and third children also have some impact, but not as much as the first child. And fourth and additional children do not have any effect at all on the women's employment decision. So that kind of makes you start wondering why then, if they're going to have an economic impact, at least in terms of women's jobs, why do women who quit their jobs not have more kids than one or at most two? So that does suggest that in addition to the female labor problems, cost of raising children in Korea may be too high, not in just terms of monetary cost, but anybody who's raised children in Korea does know that sometimes mothers have to take a hands-on strategy for schooling, for childcare, and so on. And even if monetary consideration is excluded, this type of hand-on consideration may force women to get out of the workplace, at least until their children grows up. Another interesting factor, though, is that women who do not work have a better chance of getting married than unmarried women. Women who have jobs have less chance of getting married than women who do not have jobs. So there might be some cultural consideration as well. A man is highly educated and has a very good job, he may prefer women who do not have jobs, because this trend seems to be more pronounced for educated couples. So there might be not just the economic factors, but cultural factors working against women going back into the labor force after they get married or after they have children.
Then very briefly, Professor, what do you think needs to change?
Okay, well, the report recommends more flexible working hours and labor market reforms to let women return to the workforce earlier. Government solution is to have companies guarantee childcare costs and jobs for and the jobs for women who take time off for childbirth. So it's very difficult for these companies to get replacement workers while a woman is on childcare maternity leave. And that, I think, actually reduces chances of having children, because a lot of these women report that because other office workers will get a lot more work if they take a maternity leave, they're really reluctant to take a maternity leave. So this type, the government way of protecting the jobs may actually not be very helpful for raising Korea's number of births, as well as getting women into the workforce, because companies will be more reluctant to hire women if they have to cover for these women getting maternity leave. So actually, a better solution may be a more flexible labor market, so that even if these women are fired from their jobs because they have to have children, they can find new jobs later more easier, because the labor market will be more flexible. This is how it's carried out in the United States.
We'll have to leave it there for our weekly economy review. Professor Yang, thank you as always for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Yes, that stirring music means it's time for our daily Olympics segment, Going for Gold. This is where we're previewing the Tokyo 2020 Summer Olympics and taking a look at some of Team Korea's medal prospects. Then once the games kick off, we'll bring you the latest results and updates. And we're doing all that with the help of our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, who has joined us now in the studio. Mark, hello and happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Good to see you.
There's just a week to go now until the Olympic torch is lit, Mark. Mm-hmm. The anticipation is building. Now, over the last few days, we have talked about events that Team Korea are best known for. But today, we'll be taking a look at perhaps some of the lesser high-profile events and new events as well, some of which Team Korea is vying to get a medal in. So, where are we starting, Mark?
Well, we're first going to talk about the modern pentathlon, which is an event that really carries the spirit of the, I would say, the original Olympics. We're talking about ancient Greece, as athletes had to compete in a multitude of events. It's actually simulates what the ancient Greek soldiers had to train for. It's pretty fascinating. So the event, as the name suggests, comprises of five different events: fencing, freestyle swimming, equestrian show jumping, and a final combined event of pistol shooting and cross-country running. Jeon Eun-tae and Jung Jin-hwa are representing Team Korea, which is hoping to finally grab a medal 57 years after it first competed in the 1964 Tokyo Games. That would be quite poetic if they could actually secure a medal here. Jun, the 2018 Asian Games champion, is currently ranked fourth in the world, so it's quite possible. And Jung's third consecutive Games will be in Tokyo.
Wow, fourth in the world means that Jun is definitely one to watch out for then. Okay, what else is Team Korea looking out for as well, Mark?
Well, we're on the topic of the hopes of grabbing a medal for the first time. Cycling is another sport that Team Korea is aiming to win for their first in over 70 years. 22 cycling golds are up for grabs, and Hee Hae-jin in cycling track and Na Arum in cycling road are the medal prospects. Now,
Right, this might be a bit more of a tougher ask, but perhaps an outside chance in those events. What else, Mark?
Well, in wrestling, which had been a staple medal-winning sport for us, Team Korea only has two Korean qualifiers, Ryu Han-soo and Kim Min-suk, both in Greco-Roman. And then there's table tennis, as Jang Woo-jin of the men's team and 16-year-old Shin Yu-bin of the women's team have also been doing quite well for themselves in the past 2 to 3 years. But Team Korea, they're going to have to scale the Great Wall of Team China, as they have been utterly dominant in the sport's history. For example, the Rio Games, they swept. They took all the golds.
Yes,
took them all.
Of course. They won all four golds in the 2012 Olympics as well. But that year, South Korea did at least win a silver in the men's team event. Mm-hmm. And in fact, actually, the last time China didn't win a gold for table tennis was all the way back in 2004 Athens game, and they lost to, you guessed it, South Korea.
Yeah.
That was the men's single event against Yoo Seung-min. So Team Korea has history and pedigree in the sport, but they are still underdogs against China.
That's right.
Let's take a quick look at some of the new events coming to Tokyo Games as well. What are they?
Well, as I said, baseball / softball is back, which hasn't been at the Games since the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Karate is also making its Olympic debut as well. Both sports are quite popular in the host nation, but the addition of skateboarding and surfing, which really, I would say, bring out the spirit of summer in the Summer Games, they can hopefully draw in a younger crowd, both fans and athletes. Now, sport climbing is a new event that has gained quite a bit of attention here in South Korea, thanks to star athlete Kim Jae-in. She unfortunately won't be going to Tokyo, as the qualifiers she planned on participating in were called off due to the pandemic. Mm. So that means Seo Chae-hyun and Chun Jong-won will represent Team Korea for the women's and men's events, respectively.
Yes, that is a bit unfortunate about the situation with Kim. But sports climbing, as you said, is one of the new events that I understand South Korea is quite strong in. So can you tell us more about it?
Absolutely. So, sport climbing is a single event comprised of three different disciplines. There is lead climbing. That's when athletes climb up a wall over 15 meters tall that has between 40 to 60 holds. The goal is ultimately, of course, to reach the top, but athletes will be scored on how far they progress, with each handhold counting as a single point. They have a time limit of 6 minutes. Then there's bouldering. This is on a shorter wall of around 4.5 meters. This is where competitors, unroped, need to solve so-called boulder problems. Jungwoo, have you ever been to a climbing gym, or have you seen a climbing wall with all the colors?
Sure, I've tried that a few times.
Right. So each color represents what we call a problem, right? And it's your job to solve a problem. So if I want to climb or solve the red problem, I'm climbing, only touching the red, reach the top, two hands on top, somebody calls it, problem solved, jump down, land on my feet, hopefully, right? And then I'll go ahead and I'll try to solve a new problem.
Right.
Right? So the athlete has 4 minutes to solve as many problems as possible. Then there's speed climbing. That's when two athletes, they race each other side by side on identical courses on a 15-meter wall. The first to tag the buzzer at the top advances to the next heat. This is essentially a vertical sprint of 15 meters, and it takes seconds. The world record is just over 5, but this event is brutal because even a false start, that's an instant disqualification. qualification. So it's quite tough. Now, I want to emphasize again that this is counted as a single event. So that means only two golds are up for grabs, one in men's and one in women's. And winners will be determined by combining the scores from the three different disciplines. But this has drawn a bit of criticism within the climbing community, as awards are typically given out to each discipline as a separate event. Mm. So it's like having Usain Bolt run a 100-meter dash, a half marathon, and then hurdles, and then combining his times to come up to get a score. So you might see some times, you're like, well, that's not a great time at all. But again, that athlete might have trained in a single discipline their entire life, right? So it's going to be...
So it's a bit of like a triathlon,
a
really.
Bit. Yeah, so
I
hopefully...
I can see
yeah.
why there might be controversy, but it's his first year in the Olympics.
Right,
so
that's
if the
true.
Event proves popular... That could change in the future. Mm-hmm. We will have to see. Before we go, let's briefly mention skateboarding and surfing. Team Korea, I believe, do not have any athletes in these events, but there are still some interesting young figures to watch out for, I understand.
That's right. In skateboarding, eyes are on Great Britain's Sky Brown. She was born to a British father and Japanese mother. The 13-year-old made headlines when she won a bronze medal at the 2019 World Championship at just the age of 11. And astonishingly, Brown won't be the youngest competitor. That will go to Kokono Hiraki, who is Japan's youngest athlete to ever enter the Summer Games at age 12. Team USA is bringing Nyjah Houston, who is considered to be one of the most influential skateboarders in the world today, and he's very likely to grab a medal. In surfing, Team USA and Australia are traditional powerhouses, but they'll have to look out for Team Brazil, which has been making a name for itself.
That is where we'll leave it for today's Going for Gold. Mark, thank you for those previews, and we'll catch up with you again next week.
Okay, talk to you then.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 9.31 points, or 0.28% on Friday, to close the week at 3,276.91. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 2.33 points, or 0.22%, to close at 1,051.98. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 2 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,139.5 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, we have our daily segment, Korea Trending, where we round up some of the other news stories and headlines that have been getting attention online in Korea today. Joining us on the line now for that is Walter Lee. Walter, hello.
Good afternoon, Jung-ho. How are you today?
Yes, I'm good, thank you. So, what topics do you have for us today, Walter?
Okay, we'll talk about the alarming spike in COVID-19 cases in post-coup Myanmar. We'll also find out about the heroic deed of a professional fighter. And finally, we'll learn who will be the fourth and last figure to be flying to space with Amazon founder Jeff Bezos next week.
Okay, let's get started with our first story then. And you said it's about the COVID-19 situation in Myanmar. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so Myanmar is seeing an alarming surge in COVID-19 cases as its health service has virtually collapsed since the military seized control with a coup earlier in February. According to local media and South Koreans residing in the Southeast Asian country on Thursday, daily cases of COVID-19 amounted to over 7,000 on Wednesday, or the highest figure since March of last year. The death toll stood at 145. People with COVID-19 have reportedly failed to get proper treatment, with most healthcare workers of public hospitals joining the Civil Disobedience Movement, or CDM, against the country's post-coup military regime. Currently, only military hospitals and expensive private hospitals are in operation.
And amid the situation, I understand there's a certain item in high demand as they try to deal with the outbreak.
Yeah, that's correct. This would be the oxygen canisters, which are needed to treat COVID-19. One South Korean who resides in the country's largest city of Yangon said one oxygen canister is being traded at 3 million kyat, or roughly 2 million won. That's higher than Myanmar's 2020 GDP per capita of $1,527, or 1.75 million won. But purchasing these canisters has now become impossible as the military regime has prohibited the sale of the items to private citizens from this week.
Yes, that is concerning to hear indeed. Now, you mentioned that this information is coming from the Korean community within Myanmar. How are they coping with the situation?
Well, they are expected to receive help from the South Korean government. The foreign minister said Friday that it will provide masks and self-testing kits to the Korean community. Also, it plans to consecutively send 26 oxygen generators starting from next Tuesday. Between 1,500 and 2,000 South Koreans are estimated to be residing in Myanmar. The community recently saw three COVID-19-related deaths.
Well, hopefully those provisions will get through to the community, but the situation concerning the nation at large is of a bigger worry, of course. It looks like the situation will likely get worse for now. Walter, let's continue on to our second story. What do you have for us?
Okay, so a few days ago, we talked about a local hero who saved three young boys from drowning. Well, our next story is about another hero who saved a woman from a large stray dog in the southeast city of Daegu. You could even say he was built like a superhero too, as it was Jung Won-hee, a professional fighter of the Road Fighting Championship organization. His selfless deed became known after the woman's husband wrote an online post about what happened and sought to seek out the savior's identity.
Wow, okay. So can you elaborate for us on what happened exactly?
Well, according to the husband, his wife was walking their dog, a Pomeranian, around their apartment at about 9:40 p.m. last Saturday when they were attacked by a feral dog. Jung was at the scene and apparently overpowered the stray dog with his bare hands and told the woman to run. The woman came out without any injuries, but sadly the couple's dog was injured in the attack and did not survive. The husband expressed deep gratitude to Xavier's heroic deed, citing that the stray dog was quite large and would not have been easier to subdue. After his online post, the hero was identified to be Jung.
Well, it's sad to hear that the Pomeranian did not survive, but at least the woman was okay, thanks to Jung. What did he have to say about his brave actions?
Well, he said that he had done what anybody would have done, saying he initially thought a woman was being attacked by another person when he heard a scream. He said when he reached the scene, the large dog was already viciously attacking the Pomeranian. Jung said he instantly went for the large dog and grabbed his neck to subdue him and told the woman to flee. After the woman was out of sight, Jung let the stray dog go. Jung said the first thought that crossed his mind when he ran toward the screaming woman was his infant son, adding he thinks he was able to do a good deed thanks to his son.
Right, it could have been a dangerous situation indeed, but it's great to hear such uplifting stories like these this week. Okay, let's move on to our final story now, Walter. What are we looking at?
Okay, so our final story today is about the last figure who will be flying to space next week with Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and two others. Bezos's space venture Blue Origin said Thursday that 18-year-old Oliver Damon of the Netherlands will board the new Shepard spacecraft. Damon will fly in place of the original winner of a $28 million public auction. Blue Origin said the winner, who wants to remain as anonymous, would fly on a future mission due to scheduling conflicts. In a video posted on social media, Damon said he is super excited to go into space, adding that he's been dreaming about it all his life.
Right, for those wondering how this 18-year-old managed to secure such an exclusive seat, his dad is apparently a hedge fund manager and he is said to have made that bid, although we don't know how much exactly. Okay, so two others will be joining him and Bezos. Who are they, Walter?
Okay, that would be Jeff Bezos' younger brother, Mark, and 82-year-old Mary Wallace, or Wally, Funk. Funk has been dreaming of going to space since the 1960s. She was at the top of her class in a program testing to see if women were fit to travel to space, but she and 12 others in the program would never have got the chance to fly to space after that program was cancelled. But by being part of the new Shepard spacecraft crew, Funk is likely to break John Glenn's record as the oldest person to reach space.
That would be quite amazing. Now, we talked about Richard Branson edging out to Bezos in this particular space race last week. So when's this spacecraft set to lift off?
It's actually next Tuesday. The new Shepard is set to take its passengers over 100 kilometres above the Earth's surface, which will, as Bezos has made sure to point out, is over the Karma line, which some organizations deem the official crossing line into outer space. Branson's flight reached 86.1 kilometers. After being released from its booster rocket, the passenger capsule will allow those aboard the view of a lifetime before it descends back to Earth with parachutes. The entire trip is expected to last about 10 minutes.
And that is where we'll wrap it up for today's Career Trending. Thank you for those stories, Walter, and we'll talk to you again next week.
See you next week.
come now to our weekly segment, Movie Spotlight, reviewing some of the latest releases at the Korean box office and on streaming platforms. Joining us on the line now for that are our wonderful film critics. First, we have Jason Abeshavace standing by. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Django.
And we have Darcy Paquette with us on the line as well. Darcy, hello.
Hi, Django.
So, gentlemen, this week we have two horror films once again to review, a couple of interesting titles. The first is one that lots of people have been talking about. It's the Thai-Korean occult horror film called The Medium, also known as Rangjong here in Korea. It opened in theatres, taking the number one spot at the box office, pushing Black Widow to number two. Now, the film also won the top prize at the recently concluded Bucheon International Fantastic Film Festival, which we talked about last week. Darcy, can you tell us about the Thai-Korean connection, the production of this film, and why it's been getting so much attention?
Yeah, I mean, this film, I think it's Nahongjin that most viewers are really focused on because, you know, Nahongjin is the producer of the film, and it's also based on his original story, and he was really hands-on in terms of the production and helping to shape the, you know, the overall shape of the work. It does seem that a lot of viewers have fond memories of the wailing, and so I think that's one thing that really kind of, I don't know, made people curious to see this film. But there are other things as well. You know, the Thai director, Panjong Pisantanakum, is well known for Shudder and Alone and Pimak. He's a very established director in his own right. And then there's the theme of shamanism, which is something that Korean audiences, you know, are familiar with and they respond to. And it's the kind of film that sparks a lot of conversation. So I think just people becoming curious to know what it is about this film that, you know, has got people talking so much.
Okay, so a Korean producer with a Thai director. Jason, can you tell us about this story?
Yeah, sure. It starts with a documentary team. They're following a middle-aged shaman called Nim in a rural town in northern Thailand. So shamanism has long run in Nim's family, but her older sister rejected the spirit, and so it was Nim who became a shaman instead. But as they film, Nim sees that her niece Mink she's beginning to act very, very strangely, and she starts showing signs of becoming a shaman herself. Perhaps become the next, I guess, so-called medium, so hence the title. But at this point, the documentary crew shifts their attention to Mink, hoping to capture her transformation. But it turns out that something rather sinister and, quite scary is happening.
Okay, so it's part of this found footage, faux documentary horror genre that has a long and controversial history going back to Cannibal Holocaust in the 80s, of course. And much like that film, Darcy, this film seems to be provoking some extreme reactions.
Yeah, I mean, rumors spread pretty quickly that this is a genuinely terrifying film. And so that was part of it. But, you know, it's not the kind of horror film that just kind of raises your adrenaline and kind of like a joyride and then sends you off in a good mood. I mean, it is genuinely disturbing in some parts. There are images that'll stick in your head and that won't really be possible to erase after you leave the theater. So in that sense, it's clearly not for everyone. But, you know, on the other hand, it's a really well-made film, I think, like in terms of its craft and the way that it's put together. There's a reason that it hits so hard, and that's because the filmmaking is effective. And so we have a situation right now where the film has some really harsh critics, but also some passionate defenders. So it's quite fun, actually.
Well, Darcy, which side do you land on then? Did you enjoy it, if that's the right word?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it is the right word, but I did really like it. I'm impressed by it. I do hope to watch it again at some point. And just because it is so well put together, I mean, the whole combination of the acting and then the concept. I'm a big fan of The Wailing as well. And there you can see some similarities, but it feels very different.
Well, Jason, What did you think of it? I'm sure fans of The Wailing will be interested to see this film because the fact that producer Na Hong-jin is involved. Would they enjoy it?
Yeah, I liked it like Darcy. You know, the production values are really, really impressive. It really captures this really interesting ambience. I mean, it's set in Thailand and it's always cloudy and humid. And some of the interior scenes are just truly shocking. I don't think it quite has the layers that The Wailing has. I mean, Na Hong-jin is just an incredible script writer, and he wrote the treatment for this film, but he didn't write the script. His films, when he's writing them, they go through number of redrafts. I think The Chaser had, I think it was rewritten like 40 times, and that final sequence or towards the end of the film took several months for him to write. And so I don't think it quite has the complexity that The Wailing has. And I think it's reliant on some kind of existing formulas. I think Na Hong-jin was just able to really kind of juggle and play with the genre. And his use of pacing is just truly remarkable in The Wailing. Mm. I'm not sure it quite does it in the same way. But I do think, though, that it's incredibly effective and scary. I'm quite frightened to watch it again.
Okay, I think that will be a stamp of approval to some people. Darcy, it's quite interesting, this international co-production between Korea and Thailand. It's quite rare to see this sort of co-production between Korea and other Asian countries, right?
It is really rare, but I do really hope that this encourages other filmmakers to pursue these kinds of international co-productions, you know, particularly within Asia, because I think that there's a lot of potential there. And, you know, Korea, in one sense, the market is self-sufficient. You know, the market's big enough so that, you know, Korean films can do pretty well on their own. And for a long time, people have thought of the international market as a kind of bonus. You know, the last couple of years, that's changed with Parasite and with everything else. But, you know, this movie, if it's successful here and it's successful in Thailand, you know, it's really rare for this kind of co-production, which involves real strong creative input on both sides to find commercial success. And I would be really excited to see more films like this.
Okay, so that film was called The Medium or Rangjong, and it's out now in Korean cinemas. Now, our second film this week is another horror film, this time Korean. And coincidentally, it also deals with the occult, but I understand it's shot in a very different style. It's called The Eighth Night or Jaeparire Bam in Korean. It is a Netflix production that bypassed theatres and went straight to streaming earlier this month. Jason, can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, it's by debut director Kim Tae-hyung. Some recognizable faces in here. Lee Sung-min is the big star. Also features Park Hae-jun and TV star Kim Yoo-jong. It centers around an ancient Buddhist myth, about a monster that threatened mankind until the Buddha removed its red eyeball and black eyeball, the source of its power, and hid them on opposite sides of Asia. I think it is a bit ridiculous. Anyway, but they unearthed it in the present day, and it's up to the dangerously unhinged monk to stop the two eyeballs from reuniting and, unleashing unspeakable evil.
Okay, so this film almost sounds a bit more fantastical than Medium and perhaps a bit more conventional. Darcy, how does this film compare? Is it perhaps targeting a different sort of audience?
I know, it's sort of unfair this week that we're watching The Medium and then, you know, just at the same time we're watching this movie because, despite their surface similarities, they're so different in tone and approach and kind of target audience. It's an easy film to watch. It's not particularly challenging, I would say. And so in that sense, it feels a little bit tame. But there are fans of the occult movies in Korea and in other parts of the world. And if you're looking for something very comfortable, then it might kind of work with that. But, I mean, as you can tell from the fact that Jason was laughing during the plot synopsis, it is slightly ridiculous, especially compared to something like The Medium, which feels I mean, one of the things that it's so scary is that it feels real.
I see. Darcy sounds rather underwhelmed, Jason. What did you think?
Yeah, it tries to combine a lot of things. I mean, it starts off almost like, you know, a Hollywood action film, you know, with this kind of fantastical kind of backdrop, and then it turns into more of this procedural thriller, and then you have this climax, and you have the melodrama, it's just all thrown in, and it's just not very effective. I thought the second half was better. It took me a while to connect with it. Underwhelmed.
It seems like The Eighth Night hasn't found an audience on Netflix either, unlike some films last year and early this year. Korean films like The Call and Space Sweepers, they attracted a lot of attention, while mainstream theatre releases flopped. Darcy, is that because the film itself is underwhelming, or do you think perhaps there's a change in the dynamic since then as well?
I mean, maybe both. It is really interesting to hear just kind of people talk about Netflix movies these days. And there's a narrative emerging that, compared to series, perhaps, that original Netflix movies don't have quite the energy that people expect. And actually, this movie, I think, was originally produced and intended for theaters, and then Netflix picked it up. So it may not have been planned from the start at Netflix. But I think this is one thing I've been really curious about, you know, as the audience slowly comes back to theaters, and we still don't know, you know, if that's going to happen this summer or if the virus will keep people away. But when that happens, I think it's, you know, films on Netflix are going to feel a lot less exciting than they did before. And so I'm really curious about how all of these films that are being planned and, you know, will open later on Netflix, if filmmakers are going to feel like, you know, their work is just kind of being quietly buried, and they're not getting attention that the films that have a theatrical release will get.
Interesting. Well, once again, the film is called Eighth Night. That is all for Movie Spotlight this week. Jason Darcy, thank you as always for your insights, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
And we wrap up our show there today. Join us again on Monday to continue to get your daily dose of Korean news and analysis. Till then, I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and we hope you have a great weekend. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio strives to promptly update our listeners on safety procedures during emergency situations. The following are recommended guidelines to follow in case of heavy rain. Before the rain hits, make sure your windows are sealed and check for any clogs in water drains nearby. During heavy rain, try to stay indoors and monitor the situation through your local news. If you are outdoors, stay clear of dangerous places such as lowlands, basements, and worn-down buildings. Do not approach streetlights, traffic lights, or utility poles as there is a possibility of electrocution. If you're driving, slow down to 60 to 80% of your normal speed and maintain a longer distance between cars in your lane. After the rain stops, ensure that your tap water has not been contaminated and is safe to use. If your house has been flooded, make sure all the gas and electricity is off before entering and call an expert for a safety investigation. You can call your local government for repairs of sewages and roads. Please check our website at world.kbs.co.kr for up-to-date information and procedures. Thank you.